with your permission, we'll just do this prayer of Manjushri, praise and request and mantra. We'll say Omarapata Nadi 21 times, and then we'll say B 108 times if you can, on one breath. Do you remember how to do that? Were you here, Shankar, when we did? You say Omarapata Nadi, Omarapata Nadi. I found if you have a marker at 21 or 28, you can do, you know, like 5 mantras for each one for 21 or 4 for 27. And you can end up with 108. And then you swallow with saliva. You swallow, imagine on your tongue, the seed syllable D. And it is gathering all the blessings, vast wisdom of the Buddha, to energize you for this class. And then you swallow that to your heart. Let it dissolve into your heart. Homage to my guru and protector, Manjushri, you whose intelligence shines forth as the sun, unclouded by delusions or traces of ignorance, who holds to your heart a scriptural text, symbolic of things as they are, who teaches in 60 ways with the loving compassion of a mother for her only son, to all creatures taught in the prison of samsara, confused in the darkness of their ignorance, overwhelmed by their suffering, you whose dragon thunder-like proclamation of Dharma arouses us from the stupor of our delusions and frees us from the iron chains of our karma, who wields the sword of wisdom, hewing down suffering wherever its sprouts appear, clearing away the darkness of all ignorance, you whose princely body is adorned by the 112 marks of a Buddha, who has completed the stages achieving the highest perfections of a Bodhisattva, who has been pure from the beginning. To you, O Manjushri, I bow. Om Ara Pachanadi, Om Ara Majanadi, Om Ara Majanadi. With the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one, illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind, enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so that I may gain insight into the Buddha's words and the texts that explain them. So the different traditions at the different monasteries or classes where people study, this is one prayer that's done sometime. In Tibetan, it's called Gongloma. I don't know what it is in Sanskrit. It's very famous. So, any questions in your minds from previous class that you wanted to clear up? Everything clear, right? Crystal clear. Okay, what are we talking about? Is it Dion? Dion? What are we talking about in this class?
We're talking about the 11 birth group known factors. We're supposed to go to that one and read all the way to page 52.
Okay, that's good. I thought I was going to, even if you said mind and mental, so I think we're studying mind and mental factors. We're just finishing the 11th of the 11 virtues, okay? And I think last time we talked a bit about enthusiastic perseverance, right? And so we're going to go to the next one, which I think is, what is the next one, pliancy? Let me just Yeah. So effort in our in this text that you have, it's effort. Sometimes people say enthusiasm. I think particularly good way of, so right, we say parsing that is to say joyous effort, because it's not just effort. If you add more words than joyous effort, like joyous effort in the pursuit of the Dharma, that's sort of like the definition. Joyous effort in making $1 million or messing over other people or bowling or I don't know what you had a joyous effort in. That's not called this mental factor. This particular virtuous mental factor, in order for it to be virtuous, is one that takes joy in pursuing the Dharma as effort or, you know, energy in doing that. So sometimes I've seen it translated that way. Effort just doesn't have, that's essentially what the Sanskrit word virya means, but we can also add a little bit more words to it. The next one is pliancy, also sometimes translated as suppleness. What is pliancy, the text says? It is a serviceability of body and mind due to severing the continuum of unfavorable states of body and mind. It has the function of eliminating all obscurations. It is a knower that deposits an imprint so that the mind can be applied however one wishes to a virtuous object of observation, and that serves the continuum, severs the continuum of unfavorable states of body and mind. When divided, pliancy is of two types, physical and mental. So, yeah, it's interesting, of the text that I recommended to you, this one, this text by Geshe Rapton, and I think even the text by Jeffrey Hopkins, the section from Jeffrey Hopkins' book that talks about mind and mental factors, they all seem to imply that physical pliancy is this, you know, pliancy. Here, Shinto Jangwa, this particular one is a virtuous mental factor, right? It's a mental factor. Where is it found in the five aggregates? Is it found in the five aggregates? Who do you know? Who knows? Is it Paul? I forgot. Paul? Is that Paul back there? What's that gentleman's name? Who's writing down there? Isn't it Paul? Yeah, he's pretending he doesn't hear me. Paul?
What?
So is pliancy or suppleness, this one we're doing now, is it a mental factor? I think it's on. Just put up Jim.
It's a mental factor, yes.
It's one of the 11 mental virtuous mental factors. Yes. So where is it found among the five aggregates?
You know, I'm not really sure how it must be mental.
Right. Is it in the fifth aggregate, mental consciousness?
Yeah.
No. It's a mental factor. That fifth aggregate is primary consciousness. Did you know that?
Okay.
The fifth one is just primary. All the six consciousnesses, their primary consciousness is that fifth. So it's got to be either what? Form aggregate, the body, feeling, discrimination, or just compositional factors.
You have to think it would be discrimination.
No, that's the mental factor, discrimination. Yeah. Of the feeling and discrimination are two mental factors that are both, what are they? Omnipresent or what? They're both omnipresent, right? So those two are singled out separately. All the other mental factors are included here. And I think I'm phrasing that right. There's other things in this compositional factors aggregate, but all the other mental factors are there. Do you follow? No? So this is just an aside for your general knowledge. The text is not talking about the five aggregates here, but I'm just asking. Generally, everything about you is included in your five aggregates. Oh, not say everything about you. All the impermanent phenomena of your continuum are included in your five aggregates. Permanent things are not. In fact, all impermanent phenomena in general, everything in the universe that's impermanent, can be included in five heaps or five skandhas, we call five aggregates. You have your own, you know, if we chopped up Shankha, you know, with the mental sword of Manjushri and put his body in one pile, that'd be most of what we chopped up, right? But there'd be a pile of other mental events, so all the feelings in one pile, all the discriminations in another pile, all of the other mental factors and other impermanent phenomena in another pile, and then the mental, all the primary consciousness in a fifth pile. Those are called the five aggregates. You can do that. All phenomena that are impermanent can be divided into five skandhas. So one question that comes up sometimes, why is feeling and discrimination, why are feeling and discrimination separated out from the other mental factors? Why aren't there just three mental, why aren't there just three skandhas? You know, body, mental factors, and consciousness. Why are, what does it say? Do you know? Have you heard? Why did the Buddha explain feeling and discrimination separated out from the rest? Because they're just mental factors, eh? Do you know? I forgot. What's your name? Pat Patrick, yeah. Do you know? David? No, there are other omnipresent mental factors. It's not only because they're omnipresent. Well, that's a good try. But there are five omnipresent mental factors, and the other ones are, the other three are over in this aggregate. So in the Abhidharma Kosha, there are different explanations, but one famous explanation, Abhidharma Kosha, Vasubandhu says, because they are the main factors of ordinary people and scholars entering into or engaging samsara, they're separated off. Most people, I jokingly sometimes say, the meat and potato kind of person, main thing that they deal with in the world is feelings. They want to have good taste and good odors and good, you know, sounds and sight. Well, beautiful sights, attractive friends and so forth, clean house, tactile, you know, sexual bliss and all of this sort of thing. And also mental happiness. Right, that's the main thing of the eight worldly dharmas. Is that one of the eight worldly dharmas?
What?
Desire for happiness, pleasure of the senses.
Pleasure.
Yeah. You're saying yes, right?
Yes.
Good. So one of the eight worldly dharmas. So it's one of the major things that we create negative karma about and perpetuate our samsara due to feelings. Scholars, you know, make tenet systems and philosophical systems, and they debate about that, and they discriminate this and that. And so Vasubandhu said, that's the main way. And then they argue with one another. You Sautrantikas don't know ARP about this, you know, or, you know what I'm saying? You have debates. So that's one thing. Also in Tantra, when we talk about the chakras and so forth and subtle things, as you may know, there's a relationship of these five skandhas that are related with the evolution at the time of death and other things. So anyway, there's different explanations. Anyway, pliancy is in that fourth aggregate, compositional factors, but all of the texts that I've recommended to you, none of them point out that physical pliancy is not really a mental factor. It almost sounds like it's this one has to be a mental factor because it's a virtuous mental factor, right? Physical pliancy is not a mental factor. Do you know what it is? Do you know? Have you studied about Shine?
Yeah, but I mean, that's just outcome of shine.
Actually, it's a cause. It's a cause of shine. You don't actually have shine until you have mental pliancy, physical pliancy, physical bliss, and then mental bliss. And then at that point, when things calm down, it's supposed to be it's almost like excruciatingly blissful. When that calms down, then you actually have attained shine, tranquil abiding, shamatha. So they're not a result of shine, they're a cause. Without having pliancy, you don't have fully qualified shine. We have some semblance of it now, but physical pliancy is actually a tactile object. By tactile object, I mean it's something that is experienced by the tactile consciousness. And it's essentially a movement of the winds, a purification of the prana within the body. Have you heard that expression, prana? You know what that means? Elimination of, what's the word, you know, discordant or impure winds, so that your body is able to then do whatever you want. You have that ability. Physical pliancy is something that can be, is an object of touch, and that object of touch is what gives rise to the physical bliss later. But neither of those are this mental factor. The bliss of mental pliancy also is not this mental factor. This mental factor is just that mental factor which is virtuous, which brings about a serviceability of the mind. So you can, as they say sometimes, that if you sat before a wall, it's almost as though you had the confidence you could count every atom in the wall. It's just like no problem to apply your mind to anything. Right now, do you get tired? You know, if you think, oh, I have to read this assignment. You know, your mind is not pliant or not supple. So this is something that we have to a certain degree. Whenever you engage in virtue, there's some instance of it, but we don't have fully qualified pliancy until just before we develop tranquil abiding. It's something that can be developed. In fact, if we could in this lifetime develop tranquil abiding, that would be great. Okay? So that's a little bit about pliancy. Is again sometimes translated as suppleness. Also, if you have physical pliancy, you know the stories, what do they call it? There's some kind of walking, like Milarepa supposedly. Did anyone see the movie about Milarepa? Some years ago? Remember when he walked fast? What is that called? Something Gomba means to walk. I can't remember what it's called. So that comes about from having that suppleness of that pliancy of body, physical pliancy. It's not just sort of like you just put some fish scales on your feet or something like that. It's not how it comes about. Okay, next one, conscientiousness. Sometimes translated as carefulness. How is it translated here? Conscientiousness. It is a cultivation of virtuous qualities within abiding in non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance, as well as effort, and guards the mind against contaminations. It has the function of thoroughly completing and fully establishing all mundane and supreme, supramundane success. Fully establishing all mundane and supramundane success. It's an awareness that accomplishes virtue within abiding in effort without coming under the influence of the afflictions. Okay, so to give you a little more idea of what this means, remember what were the first two of the virtuous mental factors? Okay. Oh, no, you can't look. Shame and embarrassment, is that what you were going to say?
Faith and
shame. Oh, I said the first two. I'm wrong. Yes, that's good. He's actually right, but you were actually reading my mind. I was thinking of the second and third, shame and embarrassment. So I should have said, what are the second and third virtues, mental patterns? So shame is, if we like to say better, taking oneself as an object, as a reason, avoiding non-virtue for that reason. You know, I shouldn't do this because my reputation would go down, or my so forth and so on. What's the other one called? Embarrassment or consideration for others is thinking that others would be disappointed in you if you acted in an untoward way, you know, in an improper way. This one is something similar to that without taking a particular reason, conscientiousness or carefulness. So shame, embarrassment, if you can cultivate a sense of these and also a sense of conscientiousness in avoiding negative karma, conscientious about feeling regret about the negative actions you've done in the past. I think it actually has some things. Conscientiousness with respect to the former. Conscientiousness about trying to develop good, virtuous minds for the future. I think that would be with respect to the latter. Conscientiousness with respect to the middle would mean being conscientious about watching what you're doing now, watching your mind. In conscientiousness, is the main thing watching your body, watching where your feet go?
No.
Hope
not.
Well, kind of, sort of, yeah. When I'm sitting here, I don't want to stretch my feet out and insult.
Okay. You don't want to step on ants. You don't want to be disrespectful of the objects in the gompa by stretching your legs out and so forth. That's possible too. But the main thing between body and mind, the main thing is watching the mind. Shantideva says in the Bodhisattva Charyatara, when you're walking outside, the monk should keep their head down, just looking at the space in front, maybe not to walk on ants, not to be looking around and saying, oh man, look at that, wow, I want to go over there, and you know, oh, the Goodberries is just down the street, and is, you know, I don't have that kind of conscientiousness. So conscientiousness would be something that would be, first of all, guarding the senses from having the temptation of inappropriate attention. What he's going to ask first, and then Wendy has a question.
Wait.
Okay, yes, sir.
So to use the example of stepping on an ant and not stretching my legs out, I could rationalize it by saying that if I do either of those two things, I will create a non-virtuous karma, so that's consideration towards myself. So wouldn't that be shame, possibly?
If you're taking yourself as the reason. But it can, you, if you're not, if you don't have a particular reason, you're just avoiding non-virtue in general. You just think, oh, that's not virtuous. You're not thinking because I'm going to avoid that non-virtue because it would offend the gurus or the buddhas or other communities, or I would experience some negative repercussions. It would just be this one. And when it says that it's always together with non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance, as well as effort, guards the mind against contaminations. So those three, remember, those three are three of the virtuous states of mind. Non-attachment, non-hatred, non-bewilderment, or non-ignorance. They are said to be positive states of mind that are antidotes of those things, right? But just applying the antidotes, like we're going to do tomorrow in our practice day, when we apply the antidotes to attachment, that is not the mental factor non-attachment. The mental factor non-attachment arises as a result of applying the antidote. It's kind of like the coma and the state. Remember what I said sometimes? When we do meditation we try to do analytical meditation first to understand something or to reach a particular conclusion or a state of mind like love. And then after having done that, you stop the analysis and you hold that single-pointedly. So here, these three roots of virtue, non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance, are not so much the actual conventional antidotes, like thinking about repulsiveness to the body to overcome attachment, or thinking about impermanence to overcome anger and attachment and so forth. Those, you might think that those are those three roots of virtue, but those three roots of virtue are no longer, you're no longer thinking about, those are just the result that's in the mind. So your mind is not inclined toward attachment, not inclined toward hatred, not inclined toward bewilderment, all at the same time. Otherwise, you can't apply different antidotes at the same time. You have to alternate, because the mind can only be analyzing one aspect at a time. Remember when we talked about the mind and mental factors? They share the same object and the same aspect, one of the five similarities. So when you can't have anger and attachment in the mind at the same time. Okay? So these three roots of virtue are kind of the result of that. So just the mind is not inclined toward attachment in that. And non-conscientiousness is going to be one that arises in that, with that retinue of mental factors. Okay. Conscientiousness prior to activity, so it's sort of like Dion said, before you start, or as Sarah said, before you walk, watching that you don't walk on ants or so forth. Also watching your mind. Why am I doing this? Am I doing this just out of my own ego? Is there a way that I can transform this into the Dharma? You know, when you eat your food, offer it to the Buddhas first. If you have some practice of imagining Shakyamuni Buddha at your heart, say, as you eat the food, imagine that you're offering to the Buddha at your heart. So don't focus on your own pleasure so much as the nectar coming down to Shakyamuni Buddha's holy body, and his body emanates light, purifying you, and through your pores, the light goes out and purifies all sentient beings. Conscientiousness of concordant application. What is that? I forgot. Here it says in Geshe Rapten's book, it has a different enumeration. I don't know what concordant application means. There are four kinds of conscientiousness. Conscientiousness in accumulating merit. Conscientiousness in the attainment of liberation. Conscientiousness in developing renunciation. And conscientiousness in cultivating uncontaminated virtue. Oh, I guess he's here. So he says here, the fifth one. Independence. So the first one about the past, conscientious with respect to the past, a correction of past faults in accordance with the Dharma. So that would mean, for instance, purifying negative actions of the past. About the future, an earnest intention to do so in the future, to practice virtue in the future and avoid from non-virtue. Third one in the middle, doing so without forgetfulness of the present. So that means being conscientious or careful about what you're doing now, especially your mind. The fourth one, conscientious prior to activity, a tightening of the mind, thinking how wonderful it would be if I could behave and abide in ways that faults do not arise. Yeah, I would have thought also that would meant guarding your mind before you enter into activities. And then conscientiousness of concordant application means independence on that, the previous tightening of the mind, thinking how wonderful it would be if I could behave and abide in ways in which faults do not arise. Independence on that, behaving and abiding accordingly. Okay, applying that. A quotation from Nagarjuna, the Muni, Do you know who the Muni is? Or was?
Buddha.
In San Francisco, some people think it's the municipal, what is it?
The
underground transit, or I'm not sure what the U is. Okay. The Muni taught that conscientiousness is the source of the nectar of immortality, and non-conscientiousness is the source of death. Therefore, for the sake of enhancing your virtuous qualities, respectfully always be conscientious. So these are things we may not think of all the time, but as Buddhists, these three, shame, embarrassment, and conscientiousness, are very, very important to try to cultivate. So next one, equanimity. Tangnyom. Equanimity is a discordance with afflictive states. I'm not sure what that means, how she translated that. An evenness of mind, a dwelling in a natural state, and a spontaneous abiding within, in non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance, as well as effort. It has the function of not allowing an opportunity for afflictions. So, what is equanimity? In simple language. There are three kinds of places where this word is used in the scriptures. One refers to tangyom, sort of like when we talk about pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and equal feeling. That's the same word. It may not be called equanimity in that case, translated into English, but we would say what? Equal, you know, not good or bad. It also is the name of the immeasurable equanimity, wishing that sentient beings abide in equanimity, like we talked in last Sunday's class, not close to some or distant from others, being equanimous or impartial, right? But here, it's a particular mental factor that we have semblance of now, but arises close to the achievement of tranquil abiding. Generally, in tranquil abiding, to develop shamatha, you know what I'm talking about, right? Perfect concentration. In order to do so, there are two main obstacles once you begin to try to meditate. One is the fact that the mind may lose the object of concentration due to moving off to something else. So you start thinking of something else and you forget about this. Maybe they're partially in your mind, but a lot of your mental energy is invested in other thoughts. That in general is called scattering, but the particular variety of that that's most nefarious is the one that's instigated by attachment. That one is called what? Excitement. Yeah. Excitement. So excitement is a kind of scattering, subset of scattering. Scattering could be thinking about someone who pushed your button, or you're angry about, or you're irritated, or something like that, in general. And it can include excitement, but excitement is one segment of scattering. So that's one thing that brings you away from the object. The reason that excitement is said to be more important is because that's the main thing when you get good concentration. A little bit of seeking a little bit of bliss, a little bit of mental bliss, you know, wanting to think about something else. What do you call it? Mind candy. Right? Do you use that word?
Yeah.
What did they say? Eye candy? I remember there was one lady in California where she said, she was about my age, when she saw some younger men, she said, they weren't bad to look at, there's nice eye candy. I don't know if you ever used it that way. So mind candy is kind of excitement. The other main obstacle to developing tranquil abiding is loosening of your attention on the object. So even though you're not distracted to something else, becoming a little bit dull, not holding it tightly, like I gave the example of when you're watching TV late at night, you're holding the you're surfing the channels and you drop the... Has that ever happened to you? You drop the... Or it, late at night, if you're saying your mantras and the rosary falls out of your hand, you weren't grasping it. Has that ever happened to you? all the time. So you weren't grasping it, physically grasping it, and also your mind was sinking. So sinking brings about, the sinking mind brings about a less, first a darkening of the object, it's not so clear, and then you lose your strength of apprehension of the object. So those are the two. Losing the object by going off to something else, and losing the object by the clarity and strength of apprehension of it due to sinking. So along in trying to develop tranquil abiding, you have to apply the antidotes again and again to notice those things happening and then apply antidotes to them to overcome the sinking. You might tighten your awareness, enliven the mind if the mind is beginning to sink by remembering you have a perfect human rebirth and all of the things that elevate the mind. Of course, to apply those meditations means you have to have meditated on the Lan Rim. If you haven't had some experience of the great benefits of the perfect human rebirth and the joy that that results, you can't use that antidote. So that's why the Lan Rim is very important, all of these things. When you're excited, one of the things you can do mentally, first of all, is sober the mind, remembering impermanence and death, and how this lifetime, if we were to develop concentration, it would be such a great benefit, but life is passing quickly. We're definitely going to have to leave this body, maybe go to the lower realm, sort of sober the mind so it's not so prone to be excited and going on to other things, so you can focus back on that. So you have to apply energy to avoid these faults. But at a certain point, when the mind gets trained, you don't have to think about those antidotes. You don't have to be so vigilant any longer. You don't have to use the mental factor of vigilance, or however it's translated in this text, to watch whether the mind is sinking or is excited. And then you don't have to apply the antidotes with effort to overcome them. The mind is already pre-tamed. At that point, if you still invest energy into being vigilant, you can't develop single point of concentration. You have to then give up that vigilance and abide in the state of equanimity. That's this mental factor. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you? What's your name?
Maimel.
Maimel? Michael. Oh, Michael. I should have realized, not Maimel. Oh, Miss Wendy, sorry. You can hold it like an ice cream cone straight at your mouth.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello, is it working?
Yes, it is working.
When you control your eyes, it's called custody of the eyes in the Roman Catholic monastic tradition.
Custody of the eyes.
Custody
okay.
of the eyes.
That's
and
good.
And you keep your mind on the Creator rather than the created. So in Buddhist terms, we would say you keep your mind focused on mind rather than on external appearances and sensations.
That's good. We say guarding the doors of the senses in the Lan Rim. So that's the similar kind of thing. Being conscientious would remind you, if you're conscientious, you would remind yourself to guard the doors of the senses, to pay attention to what you're looking at and not to be looking at, things that can induce lust or anger and so forth. And same thing with the other senses. That's what when Shanti Deva said, when you're walking, you shouldn't look around, and you should just, occasionally you should look up if someone comes and say, wish them a good day, and then continue on your way. As you see the great lamas, sometimes they smile and then they continue.
Don't stop and smell the flowers.
Yeah, well, there's also reason to stop and smell the flowers when you want to offer them, like Atisha did. When you see beautiful things, you can also transform them, that energy. So there's different ways. Yeah.
So you're spending time in the
business. Yeah.
Oh,
should leave them on. Put it like an ice cream cone right at your mouth. There you go.
So you're saying that excitement is a bad thing? But excitement could
no,
be a good thing,
No, the mental factor
too.
Excitement. I'm not saying excitement, what you think of excitement. Like, oh, this is exciting, you know, the Tar Heels won or something. That's
I
not excitement.
Because I get worked up about reading, you know, starting to read a good Dharma book. It
yeah, that's not the mental factor excitement. Excitement is a distracting, is a scattering of the mind due to, based on attachment. You're trying to concentrate on something, and something sort of comes into the side of your mind, this is an attractive thought, and you know, oh, it'd be nice to have to win the lottery, you know. I could, you know, my daughter and I could go to Bermuda, and then you start, what you're thinking of becomes less vivid. It's that particular thing that's called excitement, the word in English has many connotations, but the mental factor excitement is that.
So a virtuous excitement is a good excitement?
No, there's not a... You can use the word excitement in that case, but that's not this mental... The mental factor that we're talking
that's
about
not excitement.
Excitement. That's
oh.
not excitement. Okay. Just like enthusiastic perseverance, working to make lots of money for yourself alone is not joyous effort. Right? It's only joyous effort toward virtuous activity. Let me continue a little bit about equanimity here. So equanimity has to be then applied to its culmination so that the mind can abide with no longer having to think about applying the antidotes. Like say for instance, did anyone learn how to golf here or play tennis? Ping pong, I don't know, something where you had to do something again and again. You say, right, left foot out, left, right foot to turn their hips, you know. At first, right? After some time, you don't see Ivan Lendl or who plays now, not McEnroe, who's a tennis player now?
Serena Williams.
You don't hear Serena Williams under her breath saying, left foot forward, right, you know. All of those things that she had to be aware of before, they were when she's trained, she can abide in a state of equanimity and physically, this is not just mental factor, but that's an example, okay? An illustration of how you would let go of those, the need for vigilance to watch these at a certain point. If you don't apply equanimity on the eighth level or so, you don't actually achieve tranquil abiding. Because at a certain point, you've trained so well in getting rid. As soon as excitement arises, you apply antidote and you're watching whether subtle excitement is coming, you know, some of your vigilance. You're watching whether subtle thinking is there, you're applying the antidote. But once they're trained, so they're no longer arising, there's no longer a need to invest energy in that vigilance, and you have to reinvest that energy into your concentration, so all of your energy is going into that. Okay? That's the main point about equanimity. 11th, last one here, non-harmfulness. Remember what I said? Do you know what that is in Sanskrit? Ahimsa or ahimsa? You say ahimsa in Pali?
I'm from Bengal.
Oh, okay. Bengali a little bit. Yeah. So ahimsa, you hear associated with Gandhi. Okay. So that's this mental factor. What is it? It is a mind of compassion and is involved with non-hatred. Notice it, involved with non-hatred. It has the function of not inflicting injury. It is a patience that, lacking malice, observes suffering, sentient beings, thinking, may they be free from suffering. So when we talk about limitless or immeasurable compassion, it's this mental state that we're trying to develop, non-harmfulness. Is it the same as the root of virtue called non-hatred? Remember what non-hatred was? What were they? Faith, shame, embarrassment, non-attachment, non-hatred, non-bemoldment, blah, 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 blah. Remember when we said we get 11 mental virtuous mental factors? So I call these three non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-bewilderment or non-ignorance the three roots of virtue, you could say, because they're virtuous states of mind, rather than the three poisons. They're kind of antidotes to the three poisonous minds, right? So what about this? What's the difference between this and non-hatred? Can you go back in your note? What was it? What's the difference? Non-harmfulness as opposed to non-hatred. Which one was non-hatred? Number five, right?
Non-harmfulness takes it a step further in the sense of non-hatred is like lack of malice.
Mm-hmm.
It's evenness, and my understanding of non-harmfulness is that it kind of bumps it up a notch. It's just not non-malice. It's feeling for the other person suffering and wanting them to not suffer.
Mm-hmm.
But that may not be a correct understanding.
Oh, this is free. Okay. Non-hatred, Shedan Meba, in our text, it's a lack of malice with regard to sentient beings, a lack of malice with regard to sentient beings, suffering and the sources of suffering. How about non-harmfulness? Is non-harmfulness take suffering and the sources of suffering as its object? Because you can get... It does?
Okay.
Non-harmfulness?
A mind of compassion.
No, it's just taking sentient beings as its object. Non-hatred takes, you know, its objects are sentient beings who might be harming you, the suffering that you're experiencing, and the sources of the suffering, such as sticks and stones and swords that, or, you know, things like that that could be hurting you. It doesn't necessarily refer only to sentient beings. If you just get hit, if you stick your finger in the fan and cut your finger, you can get angry at the fan, right? So you would apply non-hatred would be an antidote to that, but that wouldn't be an example of non-harmfulness, which is compassion. Compassion takes sentient beings as its object, right? So that's one difference. It has the function of acting as a support for non-engagement in misconduct. Okay. Whereas non-violence, what are we calling it? Is that what we're calling it here? Non-violence? Non-harmfulness. I like non-violence. I think, isn't that what we often translate what in the West, right? Non-violent protest. No, we don't say non-harmful protest and non-violent. So ahimsa, that was one of Gandhi's apparent, you know, tenets from the beginning, as you know. So it's a mind of compassion. So compassion is takes sentient beings as its object. And there are three kinds of compassion. There's a compassion that simply observes sentient beings who are suffering and wishes them to be free of suffering. That's called compassion observing sentient beings, right? You know this. Then there's suffering observing, you could say observing phenomena, but what it means is the object is still sentient beings who are suffering, but now it is enhanced with a wisdom factor that recognizes both the sentient beings and the suffering that they're experiencing are impermanent. It's understanding some deeper kind of phenomena about the sentient beings. That's less a kind of frenetic kind of, you know, tearing your hair out of idiot compassion. You know, oh, they're suffering. A little cooler mind, recognizing this will pass. that the suffering itself will pass, that the sentient beings who are experiencing it, their experience of discomfort will pass, that they, the sentient beings, will die, and so forth. That's a wiser kind of compassion. Third kind of compassion is what, like in Lama Tsongkhapa's mantra. Didn't we talk about that in class one time when we did Lama Tsongkhapa's mantra? What's the first line of Lama Tsongkhapa's mantra? Do you know, Sarah? Migme se wei ter chen chen rezi. What does that mean?
Great treasure of non-objectifying compassion.
You could translate it as non-objectifying. How do we translate it here? The third kind of compassion. Objectless. What's it called here? Is there non-harmfulness? Does it have that division here? Maybe free of suffering. Oh, it doesn't even go into that division here. I think Geshe Repton's book, it does. So non-violence, here it's translated as non-violence. There are three kinds of non-violence. Compassion referring to sentient beings, compassion referring to phenomena, and the non-referential or non-objectifying, mikme. Mik means object. In Geshe Repton's book, if it's the same enumeration, page 135. It should be in the middle of the page, it should say non-violence if that's the same enumeration as this book. Do you see that? No? It's a different enumeration in your book? Non-violence, number 11, the 11th virtuous mental factor. So, newer edition. I've got an old edition here. Okay. So, what this means is, compassion referring to sentient beings is a compassion that arises from seeing creatures helplessly bound to samsara, to the force of their ignorant clinging to self-existent person. Compassion referring to phenomena is the compassion that occurs when one sees the transient, impermanent nature of sentient beings. That means you recognize the sentient beings who are suffering, but you recognize that they are, what's the word? Your mind is conjoined with the wisdom that understands that they and the suffering they're experiencing is impermanent. Finally, compassion referring to the non-referential or non-objectifying, they're just different ways of translating the same Sanskrit and Tibetan. Tibetan we say mikme sewe, mikme, mikmewe ningje. Mik means object or referent, the thing that you're referring to, the referent object. Me means non, there's no real, like, We conceive of sentient beings, the object, as being truly existent, inherently existent, whereas in reality they are empty of being truly existent. If you have the wisdom that recognizes the referent object is actually empty of inherent existence, that's called non-objectifying or non-referential. If the compassion that's conjoined with that wisdom is called non-referential compassion. Referring to the non-referential is a compassion that comes about when one sees that although sentient beings appear to inherently exist, in fact, they do not inherently exist. Okay? Make some sense? So when we say that mantra, Mikme Sewe Terchen Chenrezi, that's referring to Lama Tsongkhapa's Migme Sewe Techen Chenrezi, that means his speech is emanation of Avalokiteshvara, non-objectifying compassion. Migme Sewe Techen Chenrezi, Dime Kempe Wangpo Jebayang, your body, you are emanation, physical emanation of stainless wisdom of Manjushri. Because Lama Tsongkhapa is said to be emanation of Manjushri. But that, his body especially, his speech is supposed to be an emanation of Avalokiteshvara. And Dupu Malum Jongze Zangwedak, your mind is Vajrapani, you know, who's the lord of, that conquers all of the hordes of Mara. So Lama Tsongkhapa is kind of recognized in all the different traditions as being a special kind of emanation of the enlightened mind. His body was emanation of Manjushri, speech an emanation of Avalokiteshvara. You heard before? And mind emanation of Vajrapani. And you had a question back there, I'm sorry. Yeah. Can you give... Yeah, come on. You have to be conscientious. There you go. Alert.
My question is regarding a non-harmfulness and the relationship to compassion and compassion.
Put it close to your mouth so I can hear you. The relationship of non-harmfulness and compassion.
To actively...
Can you hear me? I can hear you only in the room. You have to make sure the green light is on. If it was on and you pushed it, then it went off. Put it like an ice cream cone close to your mouth there.
Okay.
Face it right toward your mouth.
So my question was regarding non-harmfulness and compassion, and I was wondering specifically how might compassion be active in the sense of striving perhaps to mitigate or eliminate or alleviate suffering.
Say that again? Compassion is the wish that sentient beings be free of suffering. So there's a difference between just having that wish. Like say in the Theravada, it says in the Theravada tradition, the arhats also had compassion. They wished sentient beings were free from suffering. But their goal was to get out of samsara, so they weren't so keen on going out and eliminating the suffering. They just wished that others were free of that. If there was something they could do immediately, they did. But traditionally, in the Theravada tradition, the Shravakayana, the Pratyeka Buddhayana, their main goal was to achieve, with renunciation of samsara, to get out of samsara for themselves. And as a byproduct, sentient beings would be benefited. So their compassion was not what's called great compassion. You know the word for compassion in Sanskrit? Karuna. Like when we say the mantra of Avalokiteshvara, Maha Karuna Kaya, great compassionate body of great compassion, or the embodiment of great compassion. Maha Karuna is great compassion. So Maha Karuna, or great compassion, is the kind of that you're talking about, is active one, like the bodhisattvas have, great compassion. From Mahayana point of view, that means taking the responsibility. I myself, it's not enough that I wish them to be free of suffering. I've got to actively, I should do, as if that's my mother out there who's suffering from previous lives, my mother. If it's not myself, the son or daughter who eliminates their suffering, who's going to do it? So motivated in that way, out of compassion, the proto-bodhisattva develops bodhicitta. Compassion is a precursor to bodhicitta. Do you know what I'm talking about? So first there has to be that active sense, I must eliminate. How can I do that? The only way I can do that is to become Buddha myself. Because only the Buddha has the skillful means, the omniscient mind, the omnipresence to eliminate, you know, knows all the methods to help sentient beings. Otherwise, I can just be flailing around helping this person a little and this, not really knowing if I'm leading them to enlightenment away from suffering. So the person motivated by great compassion recognizes that the only way that they could really alleviate the suffering of sentient beings themselves is by becoming Buddha. Then they check with their wisdom whether that's possible. They investigate the continuum of consciousness, whether we have Buddha nature. Can I become Buddha? Is it just a story, you know, fairy tale that we can become Buddha? They check and they find through their own meditation on emptiness that they can. Then they develop that firm wish, I must become, therefore, I must achieve enlightenment. That's bodhicitta. That permeates the primary consciousness, primary mental consciousness. Bodhicitta is a primary mental consciousness.
But what about our responsibilities as Buddhists for the suffering?
Can you put it toward your mouth so we can hear you? What about our responsibility as Buddhists?
For the suffering that we see around us.
Poverty. Yeah. Well, that's what the Bodhisattvas, if we've taken the Bodhisattva vow, you know, we've taken a vow to try to alleviate the suffering of sentient beings. We have to be reasonable. There's some things that we don't have the wisdom yet to alleviate, you know, like in the political arena right now. You know, there's so much, you know, the two sides, liberal and conservative, and just you don't know. How can you alleviate that? How can we do that right now? I sometimes joke, when I was younger, there was something called Heathkit. Did you ever hear of Heathkits? David, do you remember Heathkits? Well, they were even before hi-fis. Mm-hmm. Remember? You could, in one weekend with innumerable cups of coffee and your soldering iron, you could make your Heathkit. You could get it done. There are probably times when we've sat down with our friends to try to, like that, solve the world problems over innumerable Mountain Dews or pizzas or whatever. You can never, you know, we can't solve that now. But what we can do is realize the only way that we can bring about a resolution of this is for us to become closer to enlightenment. Doesn't mean that we have to wait until we're enlightened to help the dog who's suffering on the street or our neighbor who has a problem. We can engage immediately in those. But other problems, you know, we can only really affect a meaningful solution as if we attain enlightenment. So to keep that as our main goal. And along the way, one of the ways of achieving enlightenment is you have to engage in the six perfections. So you have to be generous, you have to be patient, you have to be ethical, and so forth, not harm others. And you have to try, amongst the bodhisattva vows, you have to alleviate suffering when you have a chance to do that. Okay? So, in general, virtues are taught to be of five types. Virtues by way of entity, this is on near the first third of page 48. Virtues by way of entity. So these 11 are virtues by way of entity. When those mental factors, these 11 are in your mind is virtuous. Virtues by way of relation, say for instance, if one of these virtuous mental factors is in your continuum, the mental factor intention. Remember mental factor intention? Is that virtuous or non-virtuous? It, by relation, that's the second way. That intention can become virtuous because it's moving the mind. If there's a virtuous mental factor in the mind, like non-harmfulness, and there's an intention to move the mind to something, then that's creating virtue. So that mental factor becomes virtuous by means of relationship with a virtuous mental factor. Does that make sense? Virtue by way of subsequent relation, what does that mean? Virtues by way of subsequent are imprints of virtue. Virtues by way of motivation, for instance, physical and verbal actions motivated by faith, and virtues by way of ultimacy. Virtues by way of ultimacy are explained to be thusnesses, that means emptiness, because all obscurations will be purified in if one meditates within the observation of thusness or emptiness. Therefore, they are designated as virtues, but are not actual virtues. So, virtue by way of motivation. Our actions can become virtuous due to our motivation. That's why at the beginning of practices, we spend a lot of time trying to generate a virtuous motivation. Do you remember that? The beginning of all our teachings, we say prayers and so forth. Even sweeping the floor can become virtuous if you motivate in that way. If you have a motivation before sweeping, that's the most important thing. I'm going to sweep the floor and try to think of this as training of the mind. And during that time, you think small path. Do you know the story of small path and big path? We talked before. So like small path was sweeping the temple. I sweep away dust, I sweep away stain, or I clean away dust away, I clean away dirt, I clean away stain. If you think as you're sweeping your home, And so almost like fire puja. When you do fire puja, you know, Dorje Khandro fire puja, you imagine your negativities, you throw in the fire, you physically see the sesame seeds being burned up, and you have a feeling, yeah, my negativities can be burned. In the same way, when you're sweeping, thinking, just like this, may I sweep up the negativities of my own mind and the minds of all sentient beings. When you scour the kitchen sink or the pans and things, think, just like this, may I scour, you know, my pride, my laziness, my all, you know, the faults that you recognize, and may I eliminate them from the minds of all sentient beings. So that action, by your motivation, becomes virtuous action. That's one of the very special features of the Mahayana training of the mind. When you walk up steps thinking, you know, may I lead all sentient beings out of the lower realms into the upper realms. When you go down, you think, even if I have to go to the lower realms for the benefit of sentient beings, you know, and remain there, I will do so. And so what, all of your different actions, you can be thinking like that through motivation. Okay. So let's go on. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Mr. Patrick, yeah. Just point it to you.
You sort of fast forward, at least I missed virtues by way of subsequent relation. That wasn't clear to me.
Yeah. So I think what that's referring to is, it says in the thing here, it says, our imprints of virtue. So for instance, karmic seeds on your mind stream can be virtuous or non-virtuous or neutral karmic seeds, right? So those karmic seeds that are virtuous karmic seeds, they are actually not static, they're actually changing. So those are labeled virtue by means of what? Subsequent relation? Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to talk about the what are called the afflicted states of mind, the six root delusions. Is there some? There we go. I think I might have told you once in Dharamsala when Geshe-la Wangdarge was talking about this subject, he said, there are 84,000 delusions. The first is ignorance. You know, and then, oh my gosh, where's the notebook, you know? You know, 84,000. He went through the three root delusions, or the six root delusions, rather, and then said, all the rest can be included in these six. And there was a little audible sigh in the room. There was a little fear that Geshe-la was going to go through all 84,000. So, the six root delusions, where did they start here? Page something or other, page 52, right? The six root afflictions. The word in Sanskrit, do you know the word in Sanskrit for affliction? Delusion? Klesha. Karma and klesha are the... When we talk about the Four Noble Truths, what's the first truth? Second one? Origin of suffering, right? What is the origin of suffering? Delusions?
Delusion of self-existence.
Well, there's two origins of suffering, karma and klesha. The immediate cause of suffering is karma, because the karma on our mind stream that ripens, that's the substantial cause, the immediate cause that brings about our suffering. What's the cause of the karmic seeds on our continuation? Klesha. Okay, so usually we say the origin of suffering is twofold, karma and klesha. This nice KK. Okay, then the truth of cessation, the truth of the path, the Four Noble Truths, right? So that's good to know. So klesha is sometimes is translated in Tibetan as nyonmong.
And it kind of has the implication of disturbing states of mind. That's one of the characteristics of delusions. Usually the virtuous states of mind are not disturbing to the clarity and your intent on virtue and your calmness and so forth. The delusions are. I'll intertwine sometimes calling them delusions, sometimes calling them afflictions. I'm referring to these klesha or nyomong. So there's six root klesha, and then there's 20 secondary klesha that we're going to be talking about. So the definition of an affliction is a phenomenon such that when it arises, the characteristic of being unpeaceful arises. And due to its arising, the mental continuum arises as being very unpeaceful. Okay, so it disturbs the calmness of our mind. First one in our list, attachment. Tachak. So, attachment is not the same as desire. Remember, desire, or the mental factor aspiration. Remember we talked about aspiration? What was aspiration? What category was that in? You're good at not. Was it? Object ascertaining mental factors, right? One of those. Aspiration. So aspiration was something that saw the good qualities of something and wanted to attain it. Aspiration can be good or bad. When we overestimate the qualities of that which we have some desire or aspiration for, when we superimpose upon that object qualities that it really doesn't have through the process of what's called inappropriate attention, thinking, wow, that is really nice. If I had that, I'd really be happy. Or, you know, others would be envious of me, or blah, 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 whatever. You're investing or if I had that, if I had that big jar of coffee, I'd always have coffee, not recognizing that it will finish also, or something like that. Imputing upon it qualities it doesn't have, and then because of that, intensifying your desire for that to the point that you cling to it, so that if it's unobtainable, you feel sadness. If it's taken away from you, once you got it, it feels like your heart is being pulled out. What do we talk about my heart was broken? Usually we talk about that in terms of relationships, right? I mean, maybe you talk about it. You weren't elected president of the class or something. My heart was broken, but it was something. Yeah, you could use it in that case also. Something that you were very attached to, so much as almost like in your heart. And when it was taken, the chance to get that is taken away. It's almost like your heart broke, right? So that's kind of an extreme case of attachment. Attachment is clinging of the three realms. It has the function of producing suffering. What does that mean, clinging of the three realms? What are the three realms, do you know? What's your name? I forgot. You.
I haven't been here before.
You haven't, but what's your name?
Anne.
Do you know what the three realms are?
Which three realms?
Okay, that's good. Who knows? Yeah, Miss Wendy. Usually when we talk about the three realms, all of cyclic existence can be found in the desire realm, which we're experiencing now. The animal realm is in what realm? Desire realm. Prater realm? Desire. Hell realm? The gods on Mount Meru and the anti-gods on Mount Meru? The Brahma gods? Form realm. Right? The formless gods, the formless realm. There you go. That was a no-brainer. So I could use Brahma because Brahma is the name of one of the in the highest of the form realm concentrations. So when it talks about there is clinging in all of these three realms. That's right. Even if you achieve the form, the peak of cyclic existence, there is a realm, the very highest of the formless realm absorptions. You can actually be born there, or you can achieve that concentration. Even then, there's some subtle clinging to cyclic existence. You're not out of samsara. The peak of samsara is still within samsara. You're going to fall down again. It's not as though you just easily have to make one more step from there and you're out of samsara. It's not like that. Attachment is kind of clinging, and that's a good word. It's like when you go to the restaurant, and if you or your companion knocks over the salt or pepper, the waiter comes by and says, "No problem." A little brush. Have you seen in the restaurant? Sweep that up, because it doesn't sink into the cloth, right? Maybe some particle does, but it doesn't. But if you knock over the olive oil, the waiter comes over and is quite upset and takes off the tablecloth and puts down a new one and admonishes you. Why? Because the olive oil sinks into the cloth and is not easily extricated, right? Attachment is kind of like that. Anger is kind of like the salt and pepper. Although it's damaging, in fact, it's very damaging to our mind. We create so much negativity. Attachment is in some ways more insidious. Sometimes in the Theravada tradition, we talk about the root of samsara being clinging, attachment to this, to future lifetimes. From the Mahayana, that's just a superficial take. That's not the root. But that's very much, you know, very much the flavor of it, that attachment to cyclic existence is more long-lasting than anger and hatred. Anger and hatred are more destructive immediately, but attachment has the tendency of being something that keeps us long time in samsara, like the stain in a cloth. Very difficult to extricate the mind when attachment has arisen. More easy to apply the antidotes, even though it might not seem that way when you're angry, more easy to apply the antidotes and when you're to anger and hatred and so forth, and reach an equanimous state than it is when you're attached. Okay? It is a mental factor that perceives a contaminated thing to be attractive by way of its own entity and thereupon seeks it. It doesn't have to think this is attractive by its own entity. It just thinks that is attractive, and implicit in that is our grasping at all phenomena as inherently existent. Regarding this, the foremost omniscient one, that refers to Tsongkhapa, Lama Tsongkhapa, says in the Lanrim Chamo, Great Stages of the Path, attachment observes in an external or internal object, something that's outside of your continuum or within your continuum, that is beautiful and attractive, and then becomes attached to it. Are things inherently beautiful or attractive?
No.
Why does he say observe something that's beautiful or attractive? How do things become beautiful or attractive? Partially, it depends on your karma. It depends on your karma. Some people can, you know, you put a bowl of a certain kind of food in front of someone and they taste it. And other people, depends on their karma. Well, of course, there's biological reasons to explain that, but basically it comes down, you know, if you put an Eskimo who's never been in civilization in front of a Degas painting or something like that, they might not find that attractive. Where you put someone from Switzerland who's gone to art school or something in front of, they find that pleasant for various reasons. Some of it delusions, so like you're saying, thinking, discrimination, but some of it has to do with karma, where like, say, the food, it just depends.
So you're saying that this nest is not that Australian's life?
Oh, Marmite.
Oh, it's awful.
The Australians is Vegemite. The English is Marmite.
So you had
Okay. So you have the karma to actually like this disgusting stuff.
Well, there's that disgusting stuff. There's more to it than that. Obviously, there's some things by familiarity and so forth and so on. Not everyone might have liked it as a child, but they got used to it. That's like things with us also. But there's certain things that we find attractive, that we perceive as attractive because of our karma. You know? Other things that become attractive because of our thinking about them. You know, that person is attractive because they would be a good breadwinner for my family. I want to become friends with them. Then there's a certain attractiveness because of that intellectual activity. Okay, so whatever the reason, it takes as its object a contaminated phenomena. That means not the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, not the Holy Dharma, but a contaminated phenomena, perceives it to be attractive because of either your karma or your thinking, and thereupon seeks it. Regarding this, the foremost tradition... Attachment observes an external or an internal object that is beautiful and attractive, then becomes attached to it. For example, just as oil that has been soaked into a piece of cloth is difficult to remove, likewise attachment spreads on and adheres to its object of observation, making it difficult to tear away from it. That's a good use of attachment, you know, when it's scotch tape, sort of sticks, right? Attachment, you kind of attach to something. We often mistake attachment and love. We confuse the two. We think, you know, we love someone. Actually, when we say, I love you, I think probably much of the time it's just a matter of, you please me. You know, I find you pleasant. Or what is it, attractive. Therefore, I am saying this to you because if you find me attractive, we can kind of form a mutually advantageous bond, attraction, right? We can be like that, what was it, Graves, you know, you talk about the different kinds of love, you know, there's erotic love, there's, what's the more higher kind of love? No, but there's platonic, but there's a, do you know? I can't remember, something like that. So, agape, universal love. So, you know, our ordinary love is like two planets revolving around one another, like a binary star or something, oblivious to everyone else, finding their stability. They interact with other things, but mainly... They're getting their pleasure from each other. More sort of like universal love is that. Remember, I said in the class the other day, I wanted to give a course once at the New School of Social Research in New York on Buddhism using songs. So remember the song "Love the One You're With." Yeah. That sounds terrible. Yeah, it had its own implications, but that's almost. You know, if you take the right way, you know, love whoever you're with. Give your full, you know, your full attention to them. Love them. So that is, attachment is when you have, you know, you're stuck to something. And oftentimes that prevents us from growing. If it's talking about a relationship, the more you can remove attachment from your relationship, the longer lasting it can be, the more authentic it can be. If your attachment is based on attachment, either yours or your partner's attachment, the more tension there is, the more jealousy there is. If the relationship is based on real love, you know, so when we say I love you, it's really not from a Buddhist perspective that you love that person, not that you really want them to be happy. It's that you want them to make you happy. Or they are making you happy to a certain extent because they're attractive or they're interesting or they give you sexual favors or something or they bring money. And therefore, you say, I love you It's like I love peanut butter. You know, I love chocolate. You know, I love chocolate. I love you too. You know, I love Jack Daniels. I love you. But real love is wanting the other person, it's not mixed with attachment, wanting the other person to be happy. Of course, we're limited beings, so there will always be, until we're higher realized beings, there's going to be a lot of intermixture with attachment, self-interest, and so forth. But the more that you can remove that, the more authentic and loving your relationship can be. If the other person changes and they find happiness in another person's company, wow. You love them, you want them to be happy. Can you imagine that right now? In our present state of mind, it's difficult, right? But can you imagine that? It's possible. We can develop that state of mind. So attachment, there's three types. Attachment to the desire realm, attachment to the form realm, or attachment of the form realm, attachment of the foremost realm. The function of attachment is specified as producing suffering for the purpose of making us understand that the root of all suffering within the three realms of cyclic existence, the desire, form, and formless realms, is rebirth, which connects us to cyclic existence. And the principal cause for rebirth within cyclic existence is attachment, craving itself. In the 12 links, do you know the 12 links? Very quickly, what are the 12 links?
Ignorance, consciousness,
karmic formation,
conscious,
leaving imprint on consciousness,
name and form.
Name and form. What's next?
Six senses.
Hmm?
Contact. Feeling, craving. No, contact. Yeah.
Contact.
Yeah.
Then, what's after contact?
Yeah.
No.
Feeling
comes next?
Grasping.
Is it feeling? Okay. Let's say it's feeling. Then what?
Craving.
Grasping.
Existence.
Becoming or existence.
Birth and then aging and then death.
That's only 11. So you left something on. See. Ignorance. Karmic formation. Leaving an imprint on the consciousness. Then what? Name and form.
Six senses.
Contact.
Feeling.
Craving. Grasping. Becoming. Birth. Aging with or without death. So there's two separate ones. Births and death, they're not the same.
Right.
Births, aging with or without death.
Right.
Or you say, death with or without aging, to put it that way. Death with or without aging. Because you can enter into a fertilized egg and at the very next instant, before aging has taken place, die. So they usually say that, like that. So you say death, aging and death. So craving and grasping modify the karmic imprints in our mind stream. And it's that, especially at the time of death, approaching death, that creates the karmic seeds in our mind stream to have the potency to throw us into another lifetime. So that's why one kind of attachment, craving, is said to be here the principal cause for rebirth within cyclic existence, especially, you know, from the Theravada point of view. Often they say craving. Then anger. Kondro. Anger is a malice towards sentient beings, suffering, and the phenomena that are sources of suffering. It has the function of acting as a support for not abiding in contact. And for misconduct. Is there missing some word there? It is a function of acting as a support for not abiding in contact with something. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the Tibetan text. That doesn't make sense to me. It has the function of acting as support for not abiding in contact with something and for misconduct. So what is anger? Anger is, let's look at, when we talked about attachment is something that perceives something, a sentient being or an object, as pleasant, either due to your own wrong thinking, inappropriate attention, you know, wow, that's really nice, or due to karma, without even the need for thought, and then exaggerates the qualities of that so that you want to get it, and it's as though your mind sinks into it. Anger is similar kind of thing, except it perceives something either due to karma or due to your thinking, inappropriate attention, as unattractive, burdensome, irritating. Exaggerates the faults of that and wants to eliminate that source of suffering either through striking out, verbally abusing, hiding, and keeping that anger in the mind. You know, sometimes we don't have the power to strike out in anger, and, you know, like little Johnny has been told by the teacher to write on the board, "I will not chew gum in school" 100 times. Did that happen to any of you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Shanka. Every week. And so maybe you couldn't talk back to the teacher, but there was some resentment about that, so there was anger. So you came back and you were the only child, though. Okay, so you didn't have anyone to beat when you went home. Maybe the dog or something like that. Good. You don't have to take too seriously. I'm just making jokes. But sometimes we do. You know, if we can't express our anger to a person of authority or, you know, something like that, sometimes we take it out on someone else. It's like Jack in the Box. You know that? Remember that toy? You know, you click down and you turn, and at a certain time it pop up. So if you just repress anger, it's going to come out sometime. That's not the Buddhist strategy for dealing with anger. You know, you might think, I'm a Buddhist, therefore I have to, I'm a monk or nun, I have to practice these mental factors of consideration for others and self-effacement, shame and embarrassment, whatever, and therefore I shouldn't get angry. You know, someone berates you and it's boiling inside your heart and you just, you know, I'm a Buddhist, I can't get angry. That is useful at the beginning, but then you have to work with that anger and apply the antidote. You can't just let it remain there. Just repressing anger is still there in the form of resentment or other secondary mental factors, you know, grudge and so forth. So you have to apply the antidotes to that. Otherwise, the anger will remain there. In the practice day tomorrow, we're going to talk about the antidotes to attachment and anger especially. Yes?
I read somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. That I read somewhere that anger, and I thought this was very interesting, psychology, that it's emotional violence.
Anger is emotional violence. Yeah, interesting. It's a violent state of mind.
It is a violence.
It is kind of. Remember, nonviolence is ahimsa, is essentially compassion. So that's an antidote to anger. One of the antidotes to anger.
So it's violence.
Well, it's a delusion. So all of the minds cause the mind to be disturbed. But anger, you know, is there anyone here who doesn't have a problem with anger? I asked this before. You like it, right? I know, Paul. You have a way of. Sometimes we have from previous lives certain predispositions. Some of us are more predisposed toward attachment, lust. Some of us are more sort of like bewilderment and sloth. Some of us are more predisposed toward anger. It may change during our life. But there's certain karmic imprints, and we can work with that in Tantra. Like you were talking about Yamataka, you know, there's a way to sublimate anger. Well, maybe you didn't mention that, but I think that was implication at one lecture you were talking about.
More or less joking. Actually.
You were more or less joking, but you know, there's a way to sublimate or sublimate attachment through higher practices. But in general, we have to apply the conventional temporal antidotes to these two, especially to anger and attachment. I think I told you the story many times over the years in a seminar in Tokyo, some Zen temple. I asked if there was anyone who didn't have a problem with anger, and these two men in black suits and glasses put up their hands, and the ladies next to them, they were young ladies who I think they were not their daughters, they were like, I don't know what, girlfriends or something. They looked at because obviously we all have trouble with anger, but sometimes the people who don't recognize it are the people who have the biggest problem with anger. Anger is something that we don't like to do. Do you like to be with angry people? No. There's a chance of you being hurt. It's uncomfortable. When we're angry, we become unattractive. We say things that can hurt another person and destroy a relationship that has been built up over decades sometimes. In a short burst of anger, you know, you can destroy that. Remember I said attachment is very long-lasting. That's one of its big faults. Anger is like a double whammy. You know that expression? Double whammy? You get to both ways, you know? Anger not only creates negative karma, like attachment does, but anger destroys virtuous karma that we've already created. You've heard that before, right? So it is very, very dangerous. It's something, if we were to apply antidotes, that would be the first thing we want to try to control, our anger. And then in the long term, attachment, because that's the thing that's so long-lasting and insidious that keeps us within cyclic existence. So we need to apply the antidotes. We'll talk about some of those antidotes tomorrow. You know, there are ways of meditating on that. So there's different teachings about anger. Here it says, harmful intent arises from 9 causes. Of intending to harm others, bearing senseless misgivings in the 3 times with regard to oneself, one's friends, and one's enemies. It could be translated a little more simply, I think. So this, what are the 9 causes? Someone harmed me in the past, they're harming me now, they'll harm me in the future. Holding, you know, some anger because of that. They harm my friends in the past, they're harming my friends now, they'll harm my friends in the future. What's the 3rd set? They're always on TV, they're always talking this old Chinese proverb. Everything is attributed to the Chinese. They helped my friends, my enemies in the past. They're helping my enemies now. They'll help my enemies in the future. Those are sort of the 9 causes. That's one way of talking about anger. That's useful to think about. To, you know, when we investigate our own anger, if it's, you know, then you can start to delineate a little bit better what it is. Anger is malice, a harsh mind that observes sentient beings suffering and the sources of suffering, such as weapons and thorns, and intends to harm those objects. Can you get angry at a thorn bush? Yeah. Yeah. Can you be compassionate toward a thorn bush? No. Remember, compassion takes sentient beings as its object, but anger, hatred and anger take not only sentient beings, but the suffering that you're experiencing as a result of them, or the sources of suffering, such as weapons and thorns and, you know, so forth and so on. Let me just quickly, I know I'm a couple minutes over, but just let me quickly go through some of these others just in a very quick way. Pride, nagel. Na, do you know what na means in Tibetan? I, self. Gel means what? Well, gel by itself is not a word, but gelpo means what?
King.
So you could say, I king. But I think it's one good translation of this that gets that flavor from the Tibetan translation, it's not the same in Sanskrit, is self-importance. Not gel, you know, I'm king, I'm better, you know. So we're going to talk about that also tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit about this tomorrow. Nagyal, one of the six root illusions. Then ignorance. Here it says marikpa. That's a negative particle. Ma. Rikpa means knowing or vidya. Avidya. Have you heard of avidya? That's this word. Marikpa. Ignorance. It's not simply not knowing something from Prasangika point of view. Lower tenets, it can be a certain kind of not knowing. But the real meaning of ignorance or marigpa or avidya, it depends on what language you're using, is like a proactive, it's like a misdirected wisdom. Ignorance is a misdirected wisdom that thinks in a proactive way that, let's say, the self, which is really empty of inherent existence, thinks that is inherently existent. That's an example of, you know, actually, it's not just not knowing something, it's actually proactively thinking in a distorted way. According to the lower tenets, lower than the Prasangika, which is almost all of Buddhism, it can include things of just not knowing the laws of karma and so forth, being ignorant of them, and as a result of that, engaging in non-virtuous action. We do call that ignorance also. He's ignorant of karma. He's ignorant of karma, therefore he's creating bad actions. You know, he doesn't know that anger creates bad karma, eats up his good karma, and so forth. We use it that way also, right? But from the Prasangika point of view, the real ignorance and one of the other mental factors we're going to talk about in an instant is the roots of cyclic existence. This is even before craving. The way that craving comes about is due to the ignorance that grasps to inherent existence of phenomena. So it's something that's actually active. We'll talk about this more later, but I'm just give a little foretaste now. Doubt is actually, or you could call it indecisive wavering or whatever you want to call it. Doubt here is a mental factor, so it's not just the primary mind that's that is under the influence of doubt or indecision. It's not the kind of doubt that thinks, is Goodberries on Kildare Park Road or Kerry Park Road? You know, it's not, that's not, pardon? Hillsborough, okay. There's one on Kildare Park Road. I think it was Kerry Parkway also. Okay. Anyway, doubt is an indecision about things that are significant for our spiritual development. And then so we've got six root delusions. The sixth one is called afflicted view. And there are five wrong views, five afflicted views. So if I take the sixth one and I divide it into five, how many delusions are there? 10. So you could say there are 10. You could say there are 10 views and non-views, or you could say there's 5 non-view afflictions and 5 afflictions that are views, or you can just say there's 10. But usually we say there's 6. We put all the afflicted views into one category because the main one is the view of the transitory collection. You'll see there on the bottom of page 60, the first of those. Do you know what that's in Tibetan? Do you know the Tibetan for that? Chiksokla tawa. And it's very interesting because the Sanskrit, anyway, we'll talk about that later. The view of the transitory collection, according to the lower tenets, what that means is you view the person, yourself, let's say, I don't know, what's your name? Michelle. So Michelle has an idea of her own self-identity. She doesn't?
I'm just saying everything that's being inherent
needs that. That's what that meant. Okay, good. I'll know that. Whenever you go like that, I'll know. She's not disagreeing with me. She's just saying everything is empty of inherent existence. So Michelle, Shanka, George, Dion, you know, Sarah, all of us have a sense of our own self-identity. It appears due to innumerable past lifetimes, familiarity with phenomena, grasping at them as inherent existent, it appears to us to be inherently existent. That self, it actually is merely imputed upon the aggregates. Let's say on Michelle's aggregates. What is Michelle? Michelle is an impermanent phenomena, a person who is merely designated to her body and mind. We can't find within her body and mind, especially within the mind or the mental factors or somewhere behind them, separate from them, something that is really the essence, metaphysical essence of Michelle. Like the soul or the real, what Michelle really is. But we have that feeling in our own mind. Shanka has that feeling. I have that feeling. We all have that feeling. There is a real inherently existent self. So, this afflicted view of the transitory collection takes as its referent object the conventional I, the mere Michelle, who is imputed on her transitory collection of five aggregates, takes that as its referent and misperceives it to be an inherently existent Michelle. It actually perceives takes as its object the conventional I, but the conventional I is always mixed. When I say I don't mean the eyeball, the conventional self. The appearance of the conventional self to our mind always appears mixed with the appearance of an inherently existent self. So there's the conventionally existent Michelle, there's the inherently existent Michelle mixed. We can't separate them in our ordinary lives. We have to analyze and do meditation. So this view is actually referring to the conventional I, and because it's mixed, the appearance of that conventional I is mixed with an appearance of an inherently existent I, it thinks it's inherently existent. That's called the view of the transitory collection from the Prajnagika point of view, the highest tenets. Lower tenets take a different take. All the lower tenets say it actually views not the conventional self, you know, not viewing the conventional self of Shanka that's imputed upon his transitory collection, but views the transitory collection of body and mind and conceives that to be a self-supporting, substantially existent person. We'll talk about that more later. Also said to be the root of cyclic existence. Nagarjuna said ignorance was the root of cyclic existence. Chandrakirti said the view of the transitory collection was the root of cyclic existence. They're both right. The view of the transitory collection is a subset of ignorance. Okay? The other views are holding to extremes, a conception of bad view as supreme, such as, conception of bad ethics and modes of conduct is supreme. This is the one that's often misinterpreted when you talk about the, giving up rites and rituals. You know, in the Theravada tradition, they talk about giving up rites and rituals. It's actually referring to this, giving up the conception that bad ethics and modes of conduct are supreme, such as some Vedic practices of imagining standing on one leg with pins through your body with fires in all the directions, that that's burning up your karma and that you will achieve nirvana this way. That's a mistaken kind of conduct. And then the last one is wrong view. Okay, so we're going to talk tomorrow in the practice day. We're going to especially talk about these root delusions a little bit more and talk about meditate on their antidotes. That's the greatest thing that we can do. And I will let you, whatever time, again, I went over about 15 minutes, sorry, take a little break, and then maybe you, if there's time, I don't know, you can have a little discussion. Next time, if you can, a good ringtone, okay, that's nice. I have a much more exciting one than that. If for next time you can read about the 20 secondary afflictions, the last section, and the 4 changeable afflictions. Definition is a little bit shorter. And then we'll be able to finish next Friday. Okay? Yeah. Tomorrow is a practice day, so... it's in the evening, but in the morning, it's not all day, from 9:30 till 12:30, with a couple of breaks for tea and, you know, rest. Shanka, if you weren't registered for the course, maybe you didn't get. I think Shanka,
no, we
sent out. Okay, but maybe because they weren't, they might not have gotten. So, if you're welcome to come to that.
The party.
Yeah, crash the party. Okay.